This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, online at thebdr.net. That's thebdr.net. And by Violet Microphones, on the web at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
We'll reach into the mailbag and answer some of your questions. Plus, we'll tell you a few things that you didn't know you needed to know until we told you.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And joining me from Buckley Broadcasting and WOR, it's Tom Ray. Plus from CBS Radio, we've got Chris Tobin.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, and thank you for joining us. We got a good little show today. We're going to wrap up some old business with a guy who's good at wrapping up business. It's Tom Ray from New York. Hi, Tom.
Hey, greetings, Kirk. How are you doing this evening? By the way, I'm not wearing a fancy tuxedo like, you know, Chris Tobin usually does, but does it count that I live near Tuxedo, New York?
Do you really?
Sure.
Of course. It's right up the street. Where do you think the tuxedo got its name from? Whoopi Goldberg lives there.
My question, though, is are you wearing pants?
I'm not telling. I'm not going to tell. You know, that ought to be a good trick question someday. We ought to give away a prize for that.
I don't want to know. Also joining us, and this guy from in New York, the heart of Manhattan, it's Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, everyone. How are you today?
Good. Glad you could join us from your lair of fancy clothes there, you New York City slicker.
Nothing fancy. Today was 91 degrees, and shorts and a t-shirt were required, so that was great.
Holy cow, 91, and that was in the subway, right?
Well, actually, the subway is cooler today, given another couple of months. But no, yeah, we actually had a record. I think it was 91 or 92 degrees. Charlotte, North Carolina, I think, had only 83.
We tied a record in Nashville just a few days ago. It was 87 degrees in Nashville, but no, we haven't hit 91. Hey, let's jump right into the show. You know, we've done this foundation series for a couple of weeks. Last week, we talked about frequency modulation and how that happens. We got to go a little extra long. We thought we were going to have to cut the show off at exactly 1 hour or a few minutes shy, and we got to go on a little bit farther beyond that. By the way, it was a cool show after ours, the iPad preview with Andy Anatko and with Alex doing the interview. That was quite cool. So it was worth staying up for. We're going to have kind of a listener question. Question and answer show, and we're going to wrap up anything that we had left over from AM and FM. And I sent an email out to the guys earlier today. If you have any wrap-up comments about AM or FM, let's make sure we do those. One of them that I want to make sure we hit is a question from a listener about a type of transmission that's usually called FSK, or frequency shift keying, and how that might be related to frequency modulation. Tom, I didn't get to answer this question. Frankly, I've just been really swamped the last few days, and I saw you copied me on a really good answer to this question. It was quite thorough. Can you tell us about what that is? What's frequency shift keying? Why would I want to use that? And the basis of your answer to our listener?
Well, frequency shift keying is basically a form of digital communication. It's not intended. FM is consistently, the frequency of the carrier is changed, and it's changed at a very rapid rate, at an audio rate, and it's changed almost continuously. Frequency shift keying doesn't do that. What it does is it's got two data states and a carrier, and the carrier's basic use is to kind of let the other end know that, hey, I'm here and I'm alive. Best use I could think of in broadcast where I've seen FSK used was in the older remote controls. And I'm sure, Kirk, you probably remember, and I'm sure Chris does too, things like the MRC 15 and the MRC 30, which used FSK for control. And what this did is you had a carrier frequency. Let's throw it out. It was an audio frequency, so let's throw out a number. Let's say 1500 hertz. And that would be your carrier. Now, on the other end, on the transmitter side end, if that carrier dropped for, let's throw out a number, 2 seconds, there was a stepper relay, and that stepper relay, when it saw no carrier for 2 seconds, would go back to its home position straight up, for lack of a better reference. And then when you pulsed that carrier, it would step to the first position, step to the second position, step to the third position, and let's say position three was your power adjust on the transmitter. That connected, there were a set of filters, and there were usually two relays, a raise relay and a lower relay. Those relays would now connect to the connectors on the back, which would be your raise and lower on the transmitter. And at the studio, let's say you wanted the lower power, so you'd push the lower button on the remote control, and you'd hold it for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, whatever it was. That carrier frequency would now change and go down, let's say it's a 300 hertz shift, so it would go down to 1200 hertz. When the transmitter end saw that 300 hertz shift lower down to 1200 hertz, it would go, oh, I've got to pull in the lower relay, and the transmitter power would go down. You'd release the button, it would stop. If you press the raise button, it would probably go up by 300 hertz, so it would go up to 1800 hertz. And as long as you held it in, the raise relay would pull in and sit there, and up would go your power. And that's basically what it was used for. Now our listener had sent me a note and said, well, gee, could this be used on HD radio? And while that's not what HD radio is actually used for, or I'm sorry, that's not what FSK is used for. It's intended to be a low data rate, very limited with what it can do. It's got the two states, but you have to allow enough time for the filters to say, okay, it's this state or it's that state, and for things to react. But that's what FSK is and what I've seen it used for. And I remember those old, yeah. I'm sorry, it was a PBR unit, not an MRC. It was a PBR unit. The MRC was digital. And what I remember about one that I had, the control rack was over near the edge of the building, and there was an air intake in the back of it. And every stinking winter, you'd get one of those really cold days, and the phone would ring, and it'd be the jock going, I can't lower the transmitter power, so I'd have to go down and I'd have to tweak the filter on the lower filter board. And everything would be great for 2 days. The temperature would go back up, and you'd have to drive back down and tweak in the other direction. So, but that's what we used them for, at least many moons ago.
You know, I was just looking this up, and this is coming back to me because some of this technology has been in broadcast equipment from the 70s and 80s, especially, Tom, what you were talking about in the case of remote control. They tended to use audio frequency shift keying, audio
that's
FSK.
Yep.
Yeah, now there's also carrier FSK where you're actually shifting the carrier. There's a Wikipedia article that looks to be fairly accurate about this that covers a number of different kinds of shift keying, including minimum shift keying, which is a very efficient form of coherent frequency shift keying. In minimum shift keying, the difference between the higher and lower frequency is identical to half the bit rate, which is, I guess this is the minimum that things can be moved and still be detectable and get valid ones and zeros out of the stream. There's also something that came about, at least in my world, that came about when we started having more digital satellite services, and that was phase shift keying, including BPSK, binary phase shift keying, and then there's also QPSK, which is quadrature phase shift keying. Each of these is a method of getting more data into less bandwidth. That is, more digital data into less bandwidth. And in fact, I think something that's probably worth showing, let's see, I should have gotten this link up over to Eric. Let me pop it over to him right now. Eric, I just sent you a link for phase shift keying. And if you can scroll down, go to that link and scroll down and show us the part of the page, about a third of the way down, about quadrature phase shift keying. And there's a diagram over on the far right. It's the constellation diagram for QPSK with what they call gray coding. And if you could zoom in on that, that would be pretty cool. In the QPSK section, I think you've gone down too far. That's not the one, actually. But it's a circle with four dots around the edges of the circle. So it may be on a different page than what you're looking at there. But the constellation is kind of an interesting concept. We take a signal and we vary its phase, and perhaps we also vary its amplitude. There's different ways to do this, but quadrature phase shift keying, or it's also called 4PSK or 4QAM, uses four points on a constellation diagram. And by doing this, With each little bit of RF that we're transmitting, we can represent one of four different bit states. And so we can actually transmit, get a higher number of bits per hertz than you can with you know, previous technologies like frequency shift keying or even biphase shift keying. Tom or Chris, you want to make any comments about some of these more advanced shift keying methods? And by the way, in a couple of weeks from now, we will be covering HD radio, hopefully pretty thoroughly, with an engineer from Ibiquity, and he will tell us about how the individual carriers on an HD radio signal operate, how they're modulated, and how they are able to get a really good number of bits per hertz, so a good efficiency, but also a robustness that has got to be there for mobile reception applications. So I'm sorry, back to the question. Tom or Chris, you want to chime in on QPSK or BPSK?
Hey, go ahead, Chris, your turn.
My turn. Yeah, those technologies are still actually in use when you watch cable television. You still see that. And actually, I think there are some two-way radio systems that use it as well for communication. It's very popular and very robust. And HD radio does use a type of, I guess we'll call it QAM modulation, not PCSK. So that'll be a good episode to get even more detail.
Hey, Chris, your mic's kind of down. It's a little hard to hear you. It sounds like it's getting squelched out.
Really? Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Oh, that's much better.
Oh, how about that? I guess that symmetrics process that needs to be tweaked again. But anyway, the QAM modulation you talked about is what's used on a lot of cable TV systems, so it's still around for the analog world. And the DTV and the HD radio folks now use the, what is it, the ODFM, I think is the short acronym for that. It's similar, you know, multiband, the little carriers and stuff. So in 2 weeks, that'll be a fun episode. There's a lot of good stuff going on with that.
Yeah, ODFM, and if this is a really cool subject, it's orthogonal frequency division multiplexing. Big word.
Right.
And I've got to get caught up on this. It's used in so many wireless technologies nowadays, including DVB, 802.11 A, G, and N, Flash OFDM, WiMAX
cellular
being
phones.
Used in that. So there's a lot of application there. So we'll be covering that in a couple of weeks from now. Tom, what about in ham radio? What sorts of modulation schemes are used there for transmitting data over a carrier?
I'll be quite honest with you. I haven't looked at the modulation schemes. It's probably very similar to a lot of what you use with home modems. I mean, we're limited, I believe, to 9600 baud, so it's not that high of a data rate.
Yeah.
PSK31 operates at about 31 baud, and it's a very robust thing. I mean, I can talk halfway around the world on 20 watts. But you know, that's a good question for a later show, because I'll have to look it up, because like I said, okay. I've been playing with the digital modes, but I don't I haven't really looked at it. APRS, which is one of the setups behind me here. Huh? Uses basically just 1,200 baud data comes out of the audio card on the computer. So,
gotcha. Well, let's get. Sorry to catch you off guard like that, but I am curious about some of these advanced modulation schemes that ham operators and PAC-TOR, PAC-31, other things like that will be of interest. We'll do a show to that. Let's get to a few listener questions. And we had a couple of questions about audio processing. One question we've had more than once is listeners want to know about, how do I set up audio processing for talent? In other words, mic processing. What are some of the important things to consider for various types of voices, loud and soft, shrill voices, boomy, bassy voices? What is it that, I guess a good question is, what do we want to accomplish with mic processing? What is our goal? And what are some of the parameters that we can set up within a typical mic processor in order to achieve that goal? So, Chris, you handle mic processing there at CBS for a lot of different talent. I know you've set these things up. When you consider mic processing, do you start out thinking about the talent's voice or the environment or the microphone itself or all these things? Where do you start?
All of the above. First, I start with the voice of the jock or the announcer, presenter. If it's male or female, believe it or not, if you look on an oscilloscope, you'll see the waveform of their voice. The female voices tend to be very asymmetrical. Male voices sometimes are more symmetrical. And that makes all the difference. Then the processor itself, I look to see if there's a built-in equalizer. First thing we do is we turn that off and just look for AGC. And then we look at the microphone design. And I find that in broadcast studios, radio especially, dynamic mics work the best. Now, I know there are many folks with different trains of thought or schools of thought on that, but I find that the dynamic mic is a little more forgiving to peak energy when people are speaking or if they have a high-pitched voice. It works much better. If you use a condenser mic, which is nothing wrong with it, remember the condenser mic is very fast, high, you know, transients, like high-frequency transients, similar to, say, a string instrument or you know, cymbals. And that transient energy gets through the processing, and the compressor may overdo the AGC you're trying to accomplish. So those are the few things I start with. And then you just listen.
So if someone is new to mic processing, what are some of the controls that they're going to confront? I'll cover a couple, and then maybe you guys can add to this. With any mic processor, you're going to start out with a microphone preamp, sometimes external to the mic processor, sometimes built in. And the mic preamp really has a very tough job to do. The mic preamp has to take what is a very weak signal from a microphone and amplify this to a level that is used in professional analog electronics anyway, and most mic processors do have an analog output in addition to perhaps some kind of digital output. This low-level mic signal has got to be amplified with a very low-noise amplifier. The amplifier or the mic preamp has got to have a very low self-noise. That's extraordinarily critical, especially the very first stage of amplification that the mic signal hits when it comes in. So it's critical to have this very low noise mic preamp so that when you're amplifying up to a more usable and normal professional level, you're not amplifying noise that's generated in the mic preamp itself. You want to get as clean a signal from that mic as possible and not add any noise to it. And since, you know, in with analog electronics, we are, you know, bound by the laws of physics, which kind of still dictate how much dynamic range we have and how much amplification we can get without bringing up too much noise. We've got to operate the mic preamp at a level that is reasonable. That it's if you operated it much louder, you would get clipping, because if we operate it too low, then later stages of amplification are going to have to bring that up more and therefore probably amplify some noise. So the point is, the very first mic preamp, whether it's in the mic processor itself, which it typically is, or if it's external, you want to operate this at the correct point with regard to its clipping. So a common way that broadcast engineers do this is they'll set up a microphone, maybe this like this one or maybe a dynamic mic, and they'll plug it into the mic preamp. And then, at least what I do, I will yell in the mic and make sure that I can't make it clip, but it's just under clipping. So if I turn it up any more with me yelling loudly into the microphone, the circuit will clip, and I'll either hear this on the output, or if I'm monitoring with an oscilloscope, I can see it clip with the oscilloscope. So I don't think the talent is likely to yell louder than I'm yelling, so they're not going to clip it, and that's going to get it at least in the range of where it should be. Now, if you've got talent that never, ever yells, such as at an NPR station in a quiet studio, then maybe you don't have to do the yell test. Maybe you can just do a more reasonable loud volume test. But if you're at the sidelines at a basketball game, it's really important to yell as loud as the announcer is going to yell to set that mic level. So that's the first thing that I do. After the mic preamp, then usually comes microphone expander circuit. Or sometimes the compressor circuit comes first. But the expander circuit, I'll tell you what, there's three circuits in there in many mic processors: expander, compressor, and a de-esser. Now, the expander, you can think of this as a little man who's in there, and if there's not enough mic level coming in, then this little man assumes that there's nothing important coming in, and the guy will turn the volume down. That's right, he'll actually turn it down. So if you're in a room that's got some noise, you can reduce the room noise as long as your voice is reasonably above that noise level. You can use an expander circuit to duck the noise level down when the talent's not talking and to make sure that noise doesn't get sucked up in later stages, like in a compressor that's following, maybe an on-the-air audio processor. So you use this expander to drop the noise down. What I usually do is I'll be quiet, and then I'll set the expansion depth pretty deep so I can see what's going to happen. And then I'll adjust the expansion threshold, the point at which the little man decides there's not enough audio here for me to worry with. I'll set that threshold to where it goes ahead and drops the level if I'm being perfectly quiet. And if I make any noise at all, any utterance, then the little man will let the audio come on through. And usually if you turn the expansion level too far down, then it'll have too far to come up when the little man wants to let your voice through. So it's usually not good practice to turn the expansion such that it's as deep as it will go. But, you know, 10 or 15 dB is plenty. If you turn your mic down 10 dB, well, that's quite a bit to turn it down. So an expansion depth, typically I think at 8 to 15 dB right in there is going to sound pretty good. The next thing to come along in the circuit would be the compressor. And, you know, personally, I don't mind a bit of a compressed sound. In fact, when I was setting up the Twit Studio, I set the audio processing up a little bit aggressively. And this wasn't what Leo wanted. He wanted a less aggressive processed sound. So we worked with Leo to get it the way he wanted. And, you know, he's the one doing most of the talking there, so it doesn't need to be set up the way that I want it. It needs to be set up the way Leo wants it. And then we also have a preset at the Twit Studio that is for non-Leo talent that has a bit more wide of a range. If they kind of get off mic a little bit, turn their head one way or the other, or if they don't project as loudly as Leo can, then that preset or that processing setup will be more forgiving for someone who doesn't isn't a trained voice like Leo's is. And that's what I do at radio stations. I'll set it up such that if I get much above the expansion threshold, then the compressor will start to kick in. And you want to be judicious about how you set the what's called the compression ratio. This is the ratio of how much audio comes out of the compressor versus how much has gone in. And this is when the compressor has reached its point of beginning to compress, its threshold, then this ratio kicks in. So a typical ratio might be 3:1. And that means that for every 3 dB more audio coming into the compressor, there is 1 dB more audio coming out of the compressor. So that's a 3:1 ratio on the compressor. A lot of mic compressors will do 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5 for the ratio between the input to the output when they're at the threshold or when they're into the threshold of compression. If you do too much of this, well, then your compressor really turns into a limiter. And then there's really no in between between really limiting the sound and having a totally natural sound or an uncontrolled sound. So I think there's a good balance between no compression and limiting, and that's usually what we call compression. And 2 to 3, 3.5 or so dB is good. When we produce this show, when I end up finalizing this show for publication as a podcast, I think I use about a 3:5:1 ratio on the overall compression for everybody. Guys, you got any comments about those things, the preamp, the expander, and the compressor before we get on to the de-esser and the EQ?
You forgot mentioning turning everything up to 11. That's exactly how it works.
Well, you ham radio guys might do that, and the CB guys.
No! I'm talking rock jocks. You rock set up for a rock jock, and boy, the more compressed, the better.
All right, Tom, what do you do for WOR? You got some talkers over there. How do you set up your audio processing?
We tend to keep it, try to keep it as natural as possible. We set the compression ratio for about 2.5:1. So if somebody does get a little excited and yell, it spikes a little bit and comes up and it lets you know they got a little excited. We don't really over compress. We just kind of try and keep everything on as even a keel as possible, just so we're not killing the phone calls, and it makes the board ops job a little bit easier when you have multiple people in a room to have everybody just kind of sitting there pretty much at the same level.
Okay. Tobin, how about you? What you guys do a lot of mic processing there at CBS. You've got, 6 radio stations or so.
Yeah. Well, we have the 3 FM, so that's 3 individual different types of microphone processing. 3 AM, they're all talk or news. On the AMs, on the news station, what I do is about 2, 2.5:1 for the compression ratio, but a little aggressive on the expander or the little guy at the door. What we do is run it a little heavier so that the presenter can type while he's playing in that set while he's playing some audio, he can still type something. You don't hear the typing. So I've used the expansion or the ducking to hide the typing. On the FM stations, though, the jocks like to work the microphone real close. You know, they like to take a microphone and do one of these things. So when we're doing this work, setting up the levels, we pretty much are very aggressive. And then they know to work if they'll do that to get a little effect. The trick is to work with the jocks. You know, really get them to understand, and they're in good shape. You know, their name is on the marquee, so you got to make sure they get what they want within reason.
Yeah, got you. All right. Well, next would come de-essing, and you know, a lot of mic processors have a de-esser, and in my experience, I haven't found this to be very necessary. But here's what a de-esser does, and there are different designs for these, but a basic de-esser basically is a circuit that looks for energy in a certain range of frequencies. The range of frequencies where you get energy, if you go...
Interesting.
So if you look at a... if you were to look at a spectrum analyzer, an audio spectrum analyzer of a mic output, when you go... you'll see a lot of energy, probably from 4 to 8 to 10 kilohertz, kind of in that area. I think 7 and 8 kilohertz, there's a lot of energy there with a typical Essing. And so it's a compressor that is not triggered by overall audio level. It's triggered by audio level in that frequency range where Essing occurs. And this compressor then will trigger or will it'll have a threshold that knocks down either the overall audio or just audio in that frequency range whenever that frequency range occurs. And on a lot of audio processors, and a lot of us in broadcast are familiar with the Symmetrix 528B. That's a very, very common audio processor in broadcasting. What I'll do is I will turn the main compressor off, and I will talk with a lot of sibilance in my voice and even go psst, 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 and try to find a good level that the de-esser starts really working and knocking down these S's so they don't make it on through the rest of the system, because there is a lot of energy there in that audio. So that's typically how de-esser works. There are some more sophisticated ones in some of the DSP-based mic processors that are out there. Tom?
I've never found the de-esser to work well.
No, me either. I tend to turn them off, and especially right now. So you want to say that again, Kirk?
Hey, you got some spit on my face here with all that, Tom.
Hey, sorry. It's one of those things, you know? It's a New York thing.
All right, how about EQ? Now, EQ, even if you can't afford a mic processor of some kind, most every audio console has got EQ, and there's all kinds of outboard EQ. EQ is something that is reasonably easily built and easily built into equipment, so a lot of our listeners have EQ available in their microphones.
And it's something that's very easily abused.
Oh, very easily abused. That is dangerous.
Yeah. So an EQ for a public address situation can be quite different than EQ for a broadcast situation. Also, remember that anything we do with EQ in broadcast, well, broadcasting stations, unlike public address situations, but broadcasting stations all have audio processors before the transmitter. And chances are that audio processor is going to be a multi-band audio processor. It's going to be doing audio compression in multiple bands, and audio limiting in multiple bands, and maybe even final limiting in and even clipping in two or more bands. So the audio processor that follows everything before that before the audio goes in the transmitter is going to change the tonal characteristics of what you feed it anyway. So if your audio processor is set up for, yeah, we're going to jack the bass up and really sound, you know, jamming on the air, and we're going to crack the highs up a little bit so we, you know, have that nice sparkly sound. Well, if you do the same thing to the mic processing that the jocks are talking into, then chances are very good you're going to get way too much of that effect. You're going to end up with male voices that are just too boomy and sound woo, or they're too sparkly.
Wait, you want to say that again? I missed that.
voices that are too sparkly and just, you know, great on the ear because there's just too much high end there. So, Tom, at your station, what are some of your own personal guidelines for mic EQ?
Well, for EQ in general, like I said, EQ is very easily abused. And something I learned many, many years ago, I worked at a beautiful music station that was, you know, the tapes were sent in. And I went out to see the facility one day where they were done. And one error a lot of people make with EQ is they just start cranking on it and everything has to be cranked really hot. That's not necessarily the case. And they showed me this, you know, they played a segment of some song for me, and then the guy barely touched several things on the EQ, just brought it up just a hair and kicked it in and out, and it was like night and day. And that made an impression on me many years ago. So what we tend to do, we tend to leave the low end fairly flat. I tend, you know, because we're an AM station, I tend to take it's right around 900 hertz, 1000 hertz, somewhere in there, and I put just a tiny little bump, just a little bump. What that tends to do is that brings the voice out of the radio. So, you know, since most of our listeners are either sitting at home listening on a small radio or more than likely listening in the car, it brings us up and out of that car speaker and makes it a lot easier to understand, a lot easier to listen to. And then I take the high end and try and keep that flat. Of course, at the transmitter site, we're boosting the high end just a little bit to make up for the roll-off we have with the HD radio signal in the analog side. But that's my guidelines. It's just a little bit. And the way I test it with my own voice. I take the mid-range control on the 520 AD processor. I crank it almost all the way, and I sit there and I make an adjustment with the frequency control on the mid-range, and I find where I peak and set it dead center in the middle. And then back it down and set it for maybe half a dB up, and that's it. Works like a champ.
Very light. How about you, Chris Tobin? You got several different formats going on there at CBS. Can you give away any secrets, or are these deep, dark CBS secrets?
No secret. You know, I was just talking to the engineer over at the public radio station here in New York City yesterday on the subway. We were talking about processing, and it was funny. We both agreed that the two of us could have the same processor, and we would set it identically the same, we would think, it would not sound the same on the radio. So when it comes to secrets with EQ, there are none that I can really think of. But my approach to EQ for microphones, I set it flat. First, I listen to the person who's going to use the microphone, get an understanding of the timbre of their voice. Do they have low resonance? Is it very nasal sounding? And then from there, I take the EQ, and I find a lot of times I'm turning down EQ rather than boosting. And then I complement it with the processing on the radio station itself, since most of the processing is always boosting and bringing it up to some degree. That's for the talk stations. For the jocks, for the music stations, we'll give them a little bass, you know, 1 dB or so, maybe around 150 hertz to give it a little boost. But if the person doesn't have bass in their voice and you put too much bass in on the microphone processing, it just ruins everything. So I'm very, you know, me, EQ is set flat. And I slowly play with it. I tend to find things going down rather than up work better. But
that's a very good point. And there have been EQs on the market. I think one of them was called the Little Dipper. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is not for boosting anything. It's for taking things out. And that's
exactly.
An excellent philosophy on how to EQ something. What is in there that I don't need, that sounds bad, that I want to get rid of? In fact, back to the issue of house EQ, if you're doing a public address for a concert or a church or any kind of gathering where you're amplifying voices, you may have to do, in fact, you probably will have to find where is the room resonant and drop the EQ on like a 31 channel third octave EQ. You'll want to drop things out where the room is resonant so that the room sounds more flat because the room is naturally boosting some frequencies.
That's exactly true. The room acoustics play a lot with the microphone, and if you don't take them into account, you'll have a strange sounding microphone with the audio processing and everything else.
And in PA, you may actually have to kick back some other frequencies because you're going to get feedback at some point, especially if somebody's walking around with a roving mic. Boy, as soon as they go in front of those speakers, forget it.
Yeah, of course, sure. So my own experience actually is pretty much like yours, just a little bit of EQ. I find that I tend to like to actually boost just a little bit, about 70 hertz, which is, I guess, about where my own voice bottoms out, especially if I've been drinking. then I can get down to 65, 70 hertz or so. And if I boost that a little bit, I personally like the sound. And then, sometimes format dependent, I might boost a little bit, just under 1 kilohertz to bring that voice a little bit more forward like that. And then sometimes just a little bit of high end, but it depends on what's going on the air with the on-air audio processing. Oftentimes that little boost on the high end isn't needed. A couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, we set up the studios for the Dave Ramsey Show, which is done just south of Nashville in the Cool Springs area. Dave has about 450 affiliate radio stations, so his voice goes out to a whole bunch of people. And we installed a new IP audio system there. It was an Axia system, and I was charged with helping to set the EQ up. We found that about a 1 dB boost in the 70 hertz range was working quite well for Dave Ramsey. And I think we also boosted a little bit on the – no, we didn't. No, we cut the high end a little bit. The mic he was using tended to boost the high end, so we actually cut the high end down about 1 dB. But by high end, I mean like 8, 9, 10 kilohertz, that area. So – if you're cranking on the EQ, you're probably doing something wrong. Wouldn't you say that's right, guys?
Oh, no, that's big time.
True.
Yeah.
Yep. As a matter of fact, probably, in the chat room, I think they talked about, somebody was asking about parametric equalizer, which is all well and good, but for voice, that's way too much overkill.
Yeah, parametric is more for fixing known problems. If you can identify, exactly. there's some 180 hertz power supply, three-phase power supply hum in this recording, yeah, parametrics for getting that out.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it's for.
If you have to do more than a couple 3 dB on any mic processor, there's probably some other problem you ought to be looking at. And maybe it's the only
place that might be not apply is in PA work, depending on the room and depending on the speakers you have. Because in that case, you may have to crank depending on many different things, but in a broadcast environment, no, you're right, Kirk, about 2 to 3 dB. Boy, if you're doing any more than that, you've got an issue.
Yeah, big time issue.
So, I'm going to go off of our agenda here just a little bit, guys. I put together a few papers that I'm going to provide links for on the show notes today. In a few past episodes, we've talked a lot about audio coding and what bit rates were appropriate for different kinds of audio coding. And I mentioned a paper that I picked up at the AES convention in Vienna, Austria. This was back in May of 2007. Here's what the paper looks like. There you go. I had to pay for it. In fact, if you go to the AES website, they charge you money for this. But I did find a website where a very similar paper. I don't know if it's the exact same one, but it seems to have a lot of the same data and the same findings, where this is available at no charge. So I will post that on the show notes. It's got a lot of really cool information about bit rates on codecs, and I'll show you what some of these charts look like, if I can get this in front of the camera properly. So you'll see codecs and a Mushra score, and the quality that's shown here. In fact, this kind of comes from a question that our friend in Australia, Peter Smirden, has been asking. Peter was asking about, how do we measure audio frequency response and distortion and other audio characteristics of an audio signal that has gone through or is going through a codec? Because a codec just changes everything. You can't just run tones through a codec and measure them as they come out. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work that way, because the codec is doing some serious changing to the audio, but they hope it's changing that you can't hear when that audio is fully integrated, when it's a full program going on. If you just put a tone through a lot of codecs, it doesn't sound so pretty coming out. Some are better than others. So listening tests are often used. People with trained ears and also untrained listeners as well. So this particular paper covered a number of codecs, like the DTS codec that's used on video DVDs at both 1.5 megabits per second and 448 kilobits per second. Also, Dolby Digital Plus is covered. Windows Media 9 at a high bit rate, like 448. Dolby Digital at 384, and AAC at 320. All of these codecs I just mentioned at these high bit rates perform in either good to excellent in their Mushra scores. Anybody know what Mushra means? I had that memorized, and somebody in the chat room may be able to fill us in on that.
Isn't that those funny things you smoke?
Oh, it's multiple stimuli with hidden reference and anchor.
Yeah.
Yeah, what same to you, Chris.
Multiple stimuli with hidden reference and anchor. That sounds, that's too kinky for this show.
Methodology for subjective evaluation of audio quality. Subjective.
Subjective, that's right. It's subjective. So the scoring goes from 0 to 100, 0 being very, very bad, bad, poor, fair, good, and excellent. You can score it by numbers, 0 to 100, or you can score it by bad, poor, fair, good, excellent. And so for an example of a poor sounding codec would be, for example, Windows Media Audio 10 at 192 kilobits per second was rated poor in a Mushroom score.
Kidding.
No, not kidding. Huh. Whereas
MP3, with straight voice or music?
You know, I'd have to read more about that. And this paper does describe the various different kinds of music that were used. They used applause, which is rather difficult to code. They used sax and piano, rock music by Robert Plant, actually. Tchaikovsky, they used Henry Mancini's Moon River. Harpsichord and a few others as well as some Bach and some other ethnic music. So there are quite a few different tests. So this paper, I think, is worth going over. And like I said, I'll get you the link on the show notes. So if you're listening to the show, go to the website or look on the in the lyrics area or the notes area on your iPod or whatever you're listening to, and you should be able to pick up the show notes there. It is the audio engineering side. This is convention paper 7052. If you want this one, you can go online. If you Google the title of this thing, which is EBU Tests of Multi-Channel Audio Codecs, you'll find this. Quite a good bevy of researchers involved with writing this. And like I said, we'll have that in the show notes. Another subject that I wanted to bring up. Oh, I'll tell you what, let's finish that up. Guys, what's been your own experience with codecs at bit rates? A lot of people say, hey, if you're over 384 kilobits per second, you know, any codec is going to sound unimpeachable.
There's some truth to that. I find the codecs, the data rates, it varies with the source material. If I'm doing strictly voice, male voices, I've been able to get away with some decent sound. I'm not sure what the Mushra setting would be or the rating. But with voice, male voices, I've got away with 64 kilobits over streaming audio as well as ISDN with much success. And female, I find 128 works better. And then if we're doing a combination of music and what I call complex audio, crowd noise, live location sound, I try to do at least 128 minimum, mono. And then try and squeeze as much as I can in there. But if you're doing stereo, you got to do at least 192 or 256 or better. Unless you have the bandwidth and you just go wild.
Tom?
Yeah, I would agree with Chris. I mean, when you're on ISDN or when you're doing POTS codecs, I mean, you don't have much choice sometimes in the data rate. But I found, for example, on remotes, especially now that we're an HD radio station, I found that we tend to like the AAC codec a lot better with the Tele Zephyrs we have rather than using MP3 or Layer 3, which we had done in the past. And the reason being, and it's a weird phenomenon, it's a coding artifact. I know that's what it is, but the best way I can describe it is if you could see the audio, there would be a halo around it.
Yeah, I've used that word before. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this weird ringing that's around it when it goes through the HD radio codec, where AAC, it plays very nice and it just sits there and runs. But, certain things, if I'm using AAC and if I have a choice of bandwidth and such, I mean, I'll use 128 kilobits, 256 kilobits, and it sounds great. The guys who come in, they do our staff announcing, so to speak, the voice of WOR. I got him coding at 256 kilobits AAC before he sends it in. It's a pretty big file, but it sounds decent once it hit, once we manipulate it and do what we have to do when it hits air. So that's how we tend to handle it.
256 AAC
is very forgiving.
Go ahead.
Extremely.
Sorry, AAC is very forgiving, and at 256 you can get a very, very nice sound.
Yeah, I would agree. Some people concentrate on which codec should I use and how much bandwidth do I have to have. And Another way to look at this, though, is what's the application? What are my restrictions? And what's the best codec to use for my restriction? Last fall, in September, in fact, Skip Peasy, who was on the show a couple shows ago, he pointed out this new codec that Fraunhofer had that was supposed to be equally good on voice and music at low bit rates. Now, by good, I don't mean this is contribution quality. I mean, this is for listening on your cell phone. This is the best you're going to get at 24 kilobits or 30 kilobits per second, or even down to 16 kilobits per second. And of course, I asked Skip, I said, Skip, why would you want to develop a codec for these low bit rates when it seems like we're getting more availability of faster bit rates? And he reminded me, well, Kirk, as you get the plethora of cell phones, you know, just geometric growth in cell phones out there, the cell phone networks are having a hard time keeping up. And it may very well be that you'll get a whole lot more listeners if you can get the audio out to them at 24 kilobits. And if you can do that with a codec that sounds of entertainment quality, that's good enough to listen to and not be irritating, you're going to do a lot better than trying to distribute to everybody at, let's say, 128 kilobits for people, you know, who can't get that. So this particular codec, and I'm sorry I forgot the name of it, if it had a working name, from Fraunhofer, actually was a combination of two codecs, a voice codec and a music codec, the very latest in both, and they were able to switch instantaneously and unobtrusively between these two codecs without you being able to hear the difference that the switching was going on. And there's also an AES paper about that and how that works. And it was just, I read it. I had to read it two or three times to even begin to understand what they were talking about. But I'll see if I can find that paper and put the link to that in the show notes. By the way, this paper I'm holding here that I showed you earlier was done before HEAAC was available for the testing. So that has brought a whole new dimension into lower bit rates and reasonable quality, especially HEAAC V2, version 2 of that, which added a parametric stereo portion or a factor to that codec. And it's really quite good. In fact, our listeners could probably check out, I think, there's an iPad app and an iPod app. I believe it is called Tuner 2. T-U-N-E-R 2. In fact, one of the authors of Tuner 2 is a fellow that works for Orban, a competitor for Omnia, the company that hires me, and that is Greg Oganowski. Greg Oganowski, David Frericks, and Bundenap Nyamfen have written this Tuner 2 app. You may want to check that out. It plays stations that transmit in HEAAC, and a lot of those sound really, really good. Other playback programs will do that too. Winamp will play that back, and I imagine that there are others as well. Chris, your stations, what codec do they typically use for streaming on the web? Anything particularly low bit rate?
Let's see. We're running at, right now we're doing 64-bit. Actually, I think they're trying to work on something with 32. I don't know the latest. They've been making changes with the streaming. But for on our ISDNs and when we do IP audio, we've been going with AAC, low delay, where possible. And that's been working out really well at 24K and sometimes 32 with much success.
So are you using low bit rates like 24K for contribution quality? In other words, to get audio to the station when you have to?
When we get audio to the station for remote locations, we're on sometimes a wireless network or on a DSL, and the bandwidth is somewhat questionable. If we have control of it, we'll do a higher bit rate, but a lot of times we don't have that luck. If it's a venue where we're doing music, where we're working with a record label, then we'll go with much higher bit rates, and 128, 256, where we can squeeze it in with no problem.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, you found the same thing? You're using low bit rates if you have to for contribution?
I mean, streaming wise, right now we're running two streams, a 64 and a 32 kilobit. We're considering going up to 128 in a couple of months and adding that on top of what we have. But coming in for remotes, I mean, it depends on the bandwidth. I mean, we've had good luck with, it's an AAC derivative that we've been using. It runs about 42 kilobits. If we have to, for bandwidth restrictions, we can go down to 24. But we tend to try and run it as high as possible. And we've had pretty good luck. It doesn't sound bad. And we do a lot of long-form remote programming when we bring stuff back to the station. And it sounds, surprisingly, it sounds pretty good.
I've said five times, and I'll put this in the show notes so you can get some more information on that. I want to cover another little report that I got. I mean, get to meet engineers from all over the world, and one of them is an up-and-coming female engineer in India, and she works for All India Radio, which is the government broadcast in India. Her name is Meenakshi Singhvi, and I've seen Meenakshi at several trade shows in India. She did a nice little paper on audio noise reduction techniques. And this was kind of an early effort at her at writing a scholarly paper. So I'm going to put, I think I've got it here. This is the her official CD from All India Radio that has pictures and the article on there. So I'm going to put that in the show notes as well. If I can't link to the article, I'll put the article itself online somewhere and have a link to that. I wanted to get that out because some people want to know about audio noise reduction techniques. She talks in this article a bit about noise removal from things like LPs, record albums, you know, vinyl. But the techniques are applicable to other things as well, just a noisy analog transmission, for example. Anyway, a lot of good post-production techniques that she's talking about there to get rid of noise. Guys, what else did we have to chat about? Did I assign you guys anything else?
Well, you're talking about effective noise reduction, and I have the perfect thing. It's called shut the host's mic off. Done. All depends on the program, though. It all depends on the program.
That does cut the noise down considerably, doesn't it? Oh, my goodness. We're gonna wrap the show up pretty soon here, but we'll just remind our listeners of things that are coming up. We do have a live broadcast from the National Association of Broadcasters. The folks at Telos are going to let me use a little booth, a studio there at the Telos booth at the Las Vegas Convention Center next week, next Monday, about the same time. I'm going to try to have Steve Church, the founder and CEO of Telos, on the show to talk about the future of telephony and coding and IP audio. This will just be a few hours after Steve will have been honored by the NAB with their engineering award. So that's kind of a big deal. There's a radio engineering award and TV engineering award, and Steve is getting the radio engineering award. So congratulate Steve on that, and maybe we can get him to talk to us. And if we can't, hey, we got plenty of other engineers around the Telos booth for our show next week. Then in 2 weeks.
Can we get to
talk
to Marty Sachs?
We'll get Marty on if we need to.
Yeah,
sure.
We need to get Marty on. We need to abuse Marty. Come on.
There's no telling what time we'll lose control of the meeting when Marty's on.
Excellent.
Then 2 weeks from now, Jeff Detweiler and perhaps another engineer from Ibiquity will be on to discuss some of the real technical details about how HD radio works. We're interested in the coding techniques and the transmission techniques, what kind of RF carriers and what kind of modulation is being used with that. Plus, there's some news to come along with HD radio, especially for the AM world. In fact, Tom, if you know a little bit about this, you may want to give us a little sneak preview of what Ibiquity has planned for AM stations that want to do this with HD. You got a clue?
Well, I know a little bit about it. I don't know a lot about it. We were going to do some experimenting this past fall with Ibiquity and had a problem because they didn't have a load available for our exciter, and we found that we had considerable issues interfacing another brand of exciter with our transmitter. But it looks like they've come up with a way to kind of cram all the data into the what are called the primary sidebands, which are the ones that are plus and minus 10 to 15 kilohertz out, which will free up the first adjacent, and you can then take your analog audio and spread it out to 10 kilohertz again. They also apparently have a couple of different codec modes or different codecs. One that's specifically designed for talk stations and a couple others. So there's some interesting things going on. Very, very interesting things going on. So I'd like to hear what Jeff has to say and remind him that he and I share the same hairstylist. So, you know, we need to, you know, apply the makeup just right.
Okay. Hey guys, we're gonna wrap it up here. Chris Tobin from Manhattan. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Kirk. Tom, it's always a pleasure.
And Tom from WOR, Buckley Broadcasting, thank you for being with us as well.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kirk. It's always a good time.
And our listeners, hey, you can go to our website at thisweekinradiotech.com. www.radiotech.com. You can download and get caught up on older programs. If you see a title that you're interested in, just be sure you grab it there. Be sure you leave us a comment either on the show itself or in the Speak Up forum. We're glad to hear from you there, and we try to answer some of those questions on the show from time to time. Also, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes and get it downloaded automatically. Just go to your iTunes program, go to the iTunes store, the podcasts, and do a search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, This Week in Radio Tech. Grab it that way. There's also an RSS feed available. Just go to the website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and you'll see the RSS button right there. Appreciate your comments and looking forward to a great show from the NAB next week. So long, everybody.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lope Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.